we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
The less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Western Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, September the 29th, 2017. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I'm joined here today by my co-host, Sinead Sanders.
Hello.
Our guest co-host, Natalie Zaracco.
Hi.
And our control room operator, Amir Ali.
Hello.
Welcome, everyone. Today's show is dedicated to World Day for Farmed Animals, which occurs every year on October the 2nd. This day exists to expose the needless suffering and death of sentient animals raised and killed for food, and that's what we'll be talking about today in our two interviews. For our first main interview, we'll have Sue Waters back on the show. She is the coordinator for the Vancouver chapter of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society and is working on the campaign called Operation Virus Hunter, which aims to explore the effects that salmon farming is having on wild fish populations on the BC coast. She'll be here to talk to us about the issues facing the most killed animals in the farming industry, and that's fish. Then we'll have Katie Cantrell on for our feature interview. Katie is the executive director and founder of the Factory Farming Awareness Coalition. FFAC is an educational nonprofit committed to empowering people to save the environment, animals, and our own health through our daily food choices. They give presentations across North America on all the issues that citizens should know about where their meat comes from and the standard farming industry practices. Katie will be on the show to speak about their humane education program and some of the topics they educate on, such as animal rights, the environment, workers' rights, and public health. That interview is coming up in 32 minutes, so please do stay tuned.
To start the show, we have a short interview with Valley Calderoni, the founder of Canine Valley in Squamish, BC. Canine Valley's mission is to help people understand dog psychology to encourage the correct communication and education of dogs to solve behavioral challenges. As we heard in the news 2 weeks ago, a tragic event occurred when Valley's canine soulmate and partner, therapy dog Heoru, was shot and killed by a trophy hunter who mistook her for a wolf. She's here to tell us about this incident and how it has given her a responsibility to protect companion animals and wolves alike. Hi, Valley. Thanks for talking to us today.
Hi, Natalie. Thank you so much for having me in Animal Voices. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks for being here. For our listeners who haven't been following the news, can you tell us about Keoru and what happened to her?
Absolutely. Keoru is an emotional therapy dog. She has worked with countless of people in our community, including people that suffer from anxiety to post-traumatic stress disorder and children with autism. She was a force for calmness and relaxation. She helped people feel grounded and at peace. She also was one of the foundations for our business that involves rehabilitating dogs that have been abused or they haven't been socialized or have anxiety. She was a really strong force in our lives. And on the September 18th, a Monday morning, we went on our usual hike that we have been doing for many, many years. It's a hike that we do with children, with a whole bunch of tourists goes in that location. We had an amazing time, and at the end of the hike, I heard a big bang. I crouched down out of a natural instinct, and when I look up, my dog, Taoru, had been shot. She was whining with agony and pain, so I ran towards her to try to help her out. And I could hear my partner, who was with me, Marky, scream, "Put your gun down." As I reached Kaoru, there was nothing I could do. I knew it was just devastating. And I was just there to help her ease her pain as much as I could. And then she passed. And, I think this is a tragedy. A dog that have given so much to our community was taken away by the very people that actually she helped. And yeah.
That's horrible. And the hunter who shot her, has he been brought to justice?
Well, we're working right now on creating legal actions. It's a very long and expensive process. We have created a legal fund. What this pain brought to us is an awareness of the ability that we have to actually create the communities we want. We can take action. We can make things happen in our communities. We started a GoFundMe campaign that has four main goals. The first one is going to be to protect a life zone, which is from Squamish to Whistler. Like right now, from Vancouver to Squamish, there's a 400-meter no hunting, no killing zone. And what we're going to do is we're going to expand that protection of life zone from Squamish to Whistler, hopefully a lot more than 400 meters off the highway. And we're going to create an awareness of, we are creating right now the awareness of what it actually means to protect life and educating our community. We're working with an organization called Wolf Awareness, Inc., and they provide educational materials all over Canada to inform us on what it means to hunt wolves and what it actually creates in our ecosystems and the value that actually wolves contribute. And so we're going to be pairing with them to bring that knowledge into our communities.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. I think it's incredibly brave that after such a tragedy, you were able to do that. We have one more question for you.
Valley, it's Allison here. So I just wanted to clarify for our listeners, a trophy hunter shot your dog, your companion dog, because he thought that Karu was a wolf. Is that correct? But even so, what I've been reading is that, like, it's a non-hunting zone anyways. No one's allowed to shoot companion dogs or wolves even in that area. Can you explain what happened there? Like, why was he shooting in that area, especially where there were so many people and many other companion dogs, as I understand?
Yeah, for sure. This man was poaching. So he had no right to be shooting in that area. He can shoot other animals, but wolves in that area are not allowed to be hunted. And also, just so people know, you don't require any special permits to hunt a wolf. You only need a hunting license. So the man was shooting in an area that is not allowed. He was poaching. And this is why it's important for us to take legal action, because we need to set an example. These people cannot stand for this. We cannot allow, I mean, how can we be walking in our forest with our kids and be afraid that somebody's going to shoot us?
Absolutely. There were so many children there that day. Thank you so much for sharing your story again. You can donate to Valley's campaign at her GoFundMe, which you can find on the Animal Voices website. Thank you again.
Thank you.
And now for some events. Tonight at Van Dusen Botanical Garden, the 2017 Clements Awards. Local animal advocacy group The Fur Bearers will be hosting the Clements Awards. George and Bunty Clements were the driving force behind the Fur Bearers from the 1960s until they died in 2010. And the Clements Awards was created to acknowledge those individuals and organizations who have contributed to the welfare of fur-bearing animals. The evening will feature a screening of the documentary Trophy, which is excellent. Check that one out. Silent auction, drinks and finger foods, and more. Registrants will also be able to participate in a complimentary garden tour at 4 p.m. Tickets are $45 for all that good stuff. Again, that's 6 p.m. tonight at Van Dusen Gardens. Visit thefurbearers.com to register or to learn more. Natalie, what's happening over the weekend?
Tomorrow, September 30th, is the 2017 Global Walk for Elephants and Rhinos in Vancouver. Come out to Creekside Park at 12 p.m. to take a stand against illegal poaching and protect our endangered elephants and rhinos. Also, Sunday, October 1st at 1 p.m., Surrey Chicken Save is having their bi-monthly vigil at Sunrise Poultry Processing Plant to speak for the approximately 100,000 birds that are killed there daily. Everyone is welcome to join in holding signs and handing out leaflets to a few pedestrians. And it's almost time for the annual Compassionate Thanksgiving Potluck Celebration.
Yay.
Monday, October 9th at 4:30 p.m., join us at Oak Hall for a vegan Compassionate Thanksgiving Potluck by partaking in this feast of thanks and bounty. This is your chance to build community and share delicious nourishment with like-minded people during this holiday time. All are welcome to attend. Most attendees may not be vegan, but please be sure to bring a vegan dish.
Can I just clarify, it's at the Oak Ridge Seventh-day Adventist Church, and we've been having it, I don't know, I think this is like the seventh year in a row. I started doing this as an Animal Voices event seven years ago, and now Vancouver Meatless Meetup is taking it over. I still help with them. I'm a co-organizer, so hopefully you'll see me there. So that's on October the 9th, and hopefully all of you can come as well. It's going to be a great event, and we always pack the hall with 200 people, 200 people sharing compassionate food. So it's always a good time, and I'm looking forward to it. And then I wanted to mention as well the event with the walk for elephants. That's tomorrow, right?
Yep, tomorrow.
So our show last week was dedicated to World Day for our Elephant Appreciation Day, and we featured an interview with the organizer of this event. That's Tessa from Elephant Addicts. And it was a really great interview. I wasn't here that day, but I listened to it this week on our podcast. So there's the plug for the podcast, is you can listen to our podcast at animalvoices.org if you want to check out shows that we've done in the past.
Mm-hmm. And today's show, as Allison mentioned, is in honor of World Day for Farmed Animals. So that takes this Monday, October 2nd. It was founded in 1983, dedicated to exposing the needless suffering and death of sentient animals raised and killed for food. Each year, approximately 65 billion animals are killed to produce meat, eggs, and dairy. Most of these animals are raised on factory farms where they're confined, mutilated, and raised to grow so large so quickly that many of them literally suffer to death. Even animals raised on small family farms endure many of these abuses. So on October 2nd, activists around the world are holding events including vigils, demos, and leafleting to speak up for all the animals killed needlessly for food. To register your own event or see if there's already one scheduled in your area, you can visit www.dayforanimals.org. And if you can't make it to an event but you want to support the cause, you can do that at you can do the fast against slaughter by voluntarily sacrificing all food on October 2nd. Folks are amplifying the billions of voices of farmed animals who are denied food, water, and comfort for hours or days at a time while they're being transported to slaughterhouses. So yeah, these are sensitive individuals, these animals, and their last hours of life are spent suffering in terror and starvation, and they're silenced by an industry that fights against people knowing the truth. So refuse to be silent and fast for animals on October 2nd.
It's Gandhi's birthday, isn't it?
Is it?
And that's why I think that day was chosen.
Oh, there you
Gandhi.
Go.
Choice.
Yeah. So
be the change you wish to see in the world, as Gandhi said, and stop the suffering.
Yeah, and again, you can visit dayforanimals.org for more information. If you have an animal-friendly event that you'd like to have announced on the show, please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. Our first guest today is here to talk about a farmed animal not always considered, fish, or more specifically, salmon. Sea Shepherd is a nonprofit marine conservation group that engages in direct action campaigns to protect and conserve life in the world's oceans. Among their current campaigns is Operation Virus Hunter, which aims to explore the effects that salmon farming is having on wild fish populations on the BC coast. First Nations of the area, alongside biologist Alexandra Morton, have been working to protect wild salmon and surrounding ecosystems with the support of Sea Shepherd and their research vessel, the Martin Sheen. Sue Waters is a crew member of the Martin Sheen and a coordinator for the Vancouver chapter of Sea Shepherd. She speaks with us from aboard the Martin Sheen to discuss fish farms and the ethical concerns surrounding them. Hello, Sue, and welcome back to Animal Voices.
Hello, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So World Day for Farmed Animals takes place this Monday, October the 2nd. And when we think about animals on farms, fish are not often the first species to come to mind. So for listeners who are unaware, can you describe for us what are fish farms? What do they look like? How do they operate?
Well, fish farms are basically, it's the raising of fish in pens or tanks to be sold commercially, you know, as seafood. Fish farming is referred to as aquaculture, and aquaculture is currently the way we get more than 50% of seafood that is produced for human consumption. So they're everywhere. They're globally, they're all over the place. More than 60% of them are found in China. Like, China's producing most of the fish that people consume for the world right now. We have a huge industry here in British Columbia, open pen farms. So there's different types of aquaculture. You've got your open pen farms that actually are situated in the ocean, and then you do have on land farms that are tanks that sit, you know, in open areas. They can be small, huge. Most of them are quite industrial. They can be very different, like in terms of size. They have pens that are basically a two-net system where you've got one net that sits inside that keeps the fish contained, and then an outer net which keeps predators out. And they are, you know, these sort of typical, almost like gill nets, you know, small squares. They keep in the larger fish. They don't allow, you know, smaller fish and stuff like that from getting in when they're in the ocean. That's typically what we're dealing with here on the BC coast.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, currently, right now, there's so many types of species of fish that are farmed, but the most common are salmon, carp, tilapia, catfish, and trout. That's what we see a lot that are farmed. Shrimp is also heavily farmed in the ocean as well.
And so the campaign that you're currently working on is Operation Virus Hunter, and it aims to explore the impact that salmon farming is having on wild salmon populations here in BC. What have you found? How are salmon farms affecting life in the ocean around them?
Well, they're essentially killing it. The fisheries here have suffered immensely, like the wild salmon. We're not seeing the runs virtually at all where these salmon farms sit, because they sit along the migration routes of the wild salmon coming up from the Fraser River. So we've gotten quite close to them, and in a lot of the work that's being done, like the footage being taken, we get to see inside them, which is something that's not really been shown too much. So they're filthy. Like, these farms, they don't have any kind of waste management. So they sit in the ocean. The fish are jam-packed in there. They're, you know, there can be up to a million fish in each of these farms, and they live in cramped conditions. They live within their own waste. The waste creates big dead zones under where they are, so killing off other habitats that exist on the ocean floor, in and around them. And then they just, you know, they're sort of a breeding ground for disease, and all of that disease gets spread out and spewed out into the ocean, and it's affecting and harming wild salmon. So, yeah, it's not just the wild salmon that are being affected. It's affecting everything.
Mm-hmm.
They are affecting everything.
Yeah, there are a lot of species who rely on salmon here in BC, including all sorts of sea creatures, and then all the way to bears. And we hear more about the southern resident killer whale population, how they're suffering. Definitely goes all the way down the food chain.
It does, yeah. Salmon are a keystone species. So, yeah, they support not only the sea life, you know, land animals. They also support the forests and the land as well. I mean, they're pretty vital to the health of the ecosystem. You know, to lose them would be devastating. And it's just not something that can happen. I mean, our resident orcas are, you know, they believe that they are starving, and that's one of the reasons why we're seeing them diminish and succumb to, you know, we're losing them at young ages, and it's, yeah, it's, I mean, it's definitely devastating. A lot of the, where we are up North Island, there's a lot of different tour groups that take people out to see grizzly bears and stuff like that, and they're not seeing these animals being able to catch salmon right now, and you know that's a key part of their diet, and they're not getting it. So yeah, it's definitely harming the environment big time.
Mm-hmm. And the species that's being farmed is Atlantic salmon,
yes.
Right? These aren't native to the area.
Yeah, no, and Atlantic salmon are quite salmon are carnivorous, and so they, you know, we get smaller fish coming to the farms, and you know they're feeding off of the feed that has been given to the fish, as well, and then coming into the farms, they're getting fed on by the salmon. So yeah, they definitely don't belong here. It's not healthy for them. I mean, already this is factory farming, so you know it's a terrible existence for them. Not only are they in an foreign environments. They're in a foreign space, like Atlantic salmon would travel quite a bit. I mean, their lifespan can be between 2 to 7 years, yet in the farm, you know, they're raised to about 18 months to 2 years. With no travel, you know, they're in these pens. So they would go from freshwater river systems into the ocean and then back to freshwater to spawn. And they don't have that natural life cycle at all. They sit in one place, you know, they not only do they not belong here yet, it's just not the, it's not the life they should be living.
Yeah. Sure. I wanted to touch on that because a lot of the news coverage surrounding this issue is focused largely on the ecological and also First Nations rights conflicts surrounding fish farming. And those are both very important factors that that are deserving of our attention. But one perspective we haven't heard so much about in these discussions is that of animal rights. Dr. Donald Broom, who is a scientific advisor to the British government, has stated that anatomically, physiologically, and biologically, the nervous system in fish is virtually the same as in mammals. So we now know that fish are more than just swimming vegetables or food stock. They're sentient individuals with the ability to experience pain and pleasure and memory and emotional bonds with each other. And acknowledging this, it's difficult not to conclude that fish farming does constitute animal abuse. So there's been this focus on how farmed salmon could be harming wild salmon and all who depend on them. But let's talk about the needless harm being inflicted on these salmon in the farms. Going by what you've learned so far, what would you say life is like for a fish living on a fish farm?
It's misery. Like it's absolutely horrifying, the things that we're seeing. You know, we've got, you know, and I'm, you know, primarily an animal liberationist. That's my main focus as an activist. So, you know, having to see some of the stuff we've seen pretty close up is really upsetting. I mean, these animals are diseased, they're mutated, you know, they're really suffering. Like it's not, it is animal abuse. And because of the way we view fish, I mean, only since the turn of the century have we even, started to look at the fact that they can feel pain. You know, there's that belief that fish can't feel pain. It's ridiculous. You know, obviously, like you said, you know, I don't think people look at it the same as, say, they would a chicken or a pig or a cow suffering. I mean, even amongst animal rights people, I don't think they are considered as much. And I mean, there's no way that this isn't animal abuse. It's, they live in cramped quarters. They're living unnatural lives. They live in their own waste. They literally marinate in it. It's disgusting. Like the water that they're in is just filled with it. Like you can barely see through the waste, and they swim in that continuously. I mean, we're seeing footage of salmon with their gills so inflamed because they're inhaling this through their body. And you know, a lot of the studies that I've read about and stuff too is that farm salmon have been found to have high levels of cortisol in their systems, which is a stress hormone. So, you know, they're obviously stressed out, they're sick, and they're miserable. It's definitely animal abuse. There's no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm. So whether we're talking about the ocean-based pens or the land-based ones that are, you know, perhaps causing less harm to the surrounding environment, then it's still, there's still this ethical issue here with what the fish are going through. Yeah. We talk about farmed fish versus wild fish. Some people might hear all this and think, well, I'm definitely just going to eat wild fish from now on. But Sea Shepherd, Sea Shepherd doesn't advocate for any seafood consumption at all. And in fact, all the food served on your ships is vegan. So why is that?
Yeah, well, Sea Shepherd ships are vegan because Sea Shepherd recognizes that a vegan diet, a plant-based diet, has the smallest environmental footprint. I mean, that is the main reason why we do it. We practice what we preach in that way. I mean, Sea Shepherd is a, you know, an ocean conservation organization based, their advocacy is based around anti-poaching and obviously like environmental conservation. So, I mean, that is the reason why we do it. There are a lot of people involved with Sea Shepherd that are involved in animal rights, and that also allows us a good environment for us to be involved with Sea Shepherd. One of the main reasons why I'm with Sea Shepherd is because I believe that the work that we do, a byproduct of the work that we do, is animal advocacy, because we are protecting the environment for the animals, and we are trying to promote people to really think and be conscious about what they're doing in terms of how they eat, how, what they consume. Yeah, I mean, that is why the ships are vegan. We practice what we preach.
And if anybody is interested in finding out what they're serving up on the Sea Shepherd ships, you've got two cookbooks out, right? Two Sea Shepherd cookbooks?
We do, yeah. We have two cookbooks, both written by long-term cooks on board the ships. One is Lord Kine, and Cooking Up a Storm is that one. And then the other one is by Raffin. I can't remember her last name right now. It's Pink Eat Act. Someone's yeah. having to help me. I should know this because I'm actually the cook on board, and I have used their cookbooks, you know, and it's funny being one of only two, like, Sea Shepherd doesn't discriminate in who is crew on board, so you don't have to be vegan to be a Sea Shepherd, but all non-vegans eat vegan on the ship, and because of that, we do have a very high conversion rate. Quite a few people who are non-vegans who've crewed on the ships have actually gone vegan, or at least considerably changed their diets. Like, we do hear this quite a bit. Yeah, so it's kind of just, you know, one of the benefits of having people, non-vegans, on board. It's a way to advocate for a vegan diet. And again, yeah. like I said, I'm the cook on board, so it's a lot of pressure for me as a vegan, wanting to make sure that everybody is happy, healthy, nourished, you know, and make sure that they are enjoying their vegan food, so maybe they'll go off and eat vegan.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can say from personal experience, I've got one of those Sea Shepherd cookbooks, and the Sea Shepherd's pie, I have impressed many an omnivore with that one. So if anybody's looking for a awesome. Recipe to try the Sea Shepherd's pie, give it a shot. So good. So what can listeners do to help end the environmental degradation and social injustice involved with fish farming?
What can people do? Well, one of the biggest things that we advocate is, you know, if you're not there yet, you're not gone vegan, you haven't stopped eating fish, the very least you could do is boycott farmed salmon of any kind. I mean, these farms are literally killing our coastline. They're killing the people that rely on the wild fish to survive, the indigenous people. You know, we talk a lot about reconciliation in this country lately, and, you know, it seems to be more of a buzzword than an action word. You know, if people care about indigenous people and how they're treated by this government, this issue, it is pretty paramount. Like, reconciliation means nothing if you don't act on it. You know, this ocean is being impacted by the. So yeah, basically stand up, say no, get involved in the fight. That's what I can recommend.
Yep, as we like to remind people on this show, humans are animals and human rights are animal rights. You know, get educated, stand with First Nations, stand with animals, and for those of us with the privilege to choose, do the whole planet a favor and learn how to eat without animal products.
Yeah, right? Definitely. That's the number one thing you can do. I mean, all of us who live in privilege and have access to everything else, you know, we do not need to be consuming anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's suffering, yeah.
Yeah, we're losing our connection from you a little bit, and I think that's just fine timing because we got to let you go serve lunch on the Martin Sheen.
Yeah, I got about 7 minutes here.
All right. All right, well, thank you so much, Sue, for providing a voice for the farmed fish on our show here today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
To learn more about salmon farming and Sea Shepherd's Operation Virus Hunter campaign, you can visit their website at www.seashepherd.org. And I would recommend checking out their website at some point today because Sue told me they've got a new video coming out that focuses on the plight of farmed salmon. So do make sure to check that one out. You are listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM, CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, BC, Canada, unceded Coast Salish Territories. And now we've got some news. I'm just going to continue on here on this salmon topic and give a bit of an update on the occupations that have been happening on the salmon farms here in BC. Namjee's First Nation protesters have ended their occupation of the Marine Harvest Salmon Farm at Swanson Island and will monitor the site from a group of cabins located nearby. And protesters have been at fish farms at Swanson and Midsummer Islands for the past several weeks, demanding that ocean-based fish farms be removed from their traditional territory. A shelter built by the protesters was occupied for at least 2 weeks and remains in place on the Swanson fish farm. First Nations protesters are still camped at the company's Midsummer Island farm. Marine Harvest has asked them to stay off the farm, citing concerns for their safety, concerns for protesters' safety, or concerns for their profits. Who knows? But traditional leader from the Namjee's First Nation, Ernest Alfred, has said, we have been clear that no more Atlantic salmon are to be brought into these farms. There's going to be a huge response if they try to bring juvenile salmon here. Our members are prepared to be charged. So definitely keep an eye on those occupations and support First Nations here. These fish farms are affecting these people's way of life, and they're just there without permission on these people's lands. So it's it's an insane
and again it's intersecting issues again, right? It's not so we're here to speak primarily about animal rights issues, as Sue was talking about in that excellent interview, but there are also human rights issues here at play, and environmental and public health.
Humans are animals. Human rights are animal rights, and
same thing.
And yeah, also related news here, a young member of the endangered southern resident orca population living off the BC coast has died. J52, a male southern resident killer whale, was last spotted near the Strait of Juan de Fuca south of Vancouver Island on September 15th. The 2.5-year-old whale appeared lethargic and was barely surfacing, with photos showing signs he was malnourished. Researchers say the Chinook salmon the orcas eat have been in short supply this year. J52 was not spotted when his pod was observed in Puget Sound on September 19th, and it's believed he died of malnutrition hours after he was last seen. Scientists say there were 78 resident killer whales as of last December, and warned that noise, toxic contamination, and lack of food threatened their long-term survival. Are you listening, salmon farmers? there's a lot of connected issues here.
And in other news, in an ill-advised attempt to raise breast cancer awareness, a company called Agroplastics, the company that makes the tiny hutches calves are kept in after they are taken from their mothers, has partnered with the National Breast Cancer Foundation to create a campaign called Hutches for Hope. They are creating pink calf hutches for Breast Cancer Awareness Month. That's right. A move I can only assume they thought would be adorable.
If you can't believe it, check our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. I thought this was actually a joke.
I thought it was from The Onion. Yeah, I really did. I thought it was from The Onion.
Yeah. That's absurd.
Yeah, and I want to thank vegan ecofeminist Carol J. Adams for posting this on her wall this week. That's what brought it to my attention. It's just ridiculous. Like, I don't understand it, because I want to get your thoughts.
Well, I mean, the dairy industry is trying to support women's health issues, but what about the lives of the female cows? Yeah. Cows are mammals, just like humans, and their lactations are meant for their babies, not us.
If you see this ad, it shows a photo of a human family that's all together and happy, juxtaposed by this lone male or female calf on his or her own beside this disgusting little crate that they have to stay in for the first two or three months of their lives, and they're taken away from their mothers within 15 minutes of being born. It's insanity to me when you see this kind of juxtaposition, I think, in the media, and they're trying to portray it as a happy thing.
Oh, it's happy because it's pink.
I didn't even know there was a company called Agroplastics before. Yeah. So I don't know. Do they want the publicity? I guess they do.
Yeah. Not to mention the connections between breast cancer and dairy consumption. Those have been documented as well. So
right. Absolutely. And on a slightly brighter note, according to plantbasednews.org, the U.S. plant-based food market has seen a massive spike in the past year, with dairy alternatives having increased with 20%. According to new data, American retail sales of vegan foods and beverages grew 8.1% in the last 12 months. I can only hope that the dairy industry's poor marketing strategies will help speed up the growth of plant-based alternatives even more.
Indeed.
For our feature interview today, we have Katie Cantrell on the show, who is the founder and executive director of an organization based in the U.S. called the Factory Farming Awareness Coalition. FFAC is an educational nonprofit committed to empowering people to save the environment, animals, and our own health through our daily food choices. FFAC uses grassroots education to spread the idea that every meal we eat can be a powerful form of activism. On today's show for World Day for Farmed Animals on October 2nd, Katie is here to tell us about some of the issues on factory farming that she educates on. Hello, Katie, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for coming in. I'm excited to speak with you today. Can you tell me about your work at the Factory Farming Awareness Coalition? You founded the organization in 2010. Can you tell us what instigated this and what the primary strategies are of the FFAC in conveying information and education to the public?
Sure. So I went to UC Berkeley, and that's where I was introduced to animal advocacy. I joined a student group on campus and learned about factory farming and knew I wanted to really dedicate myself to ending it. And when I graduated from UC Berkeley, I wasn't sure what avenue my activism should take, but I read the book Eating Animals by Jonathan Safran Foer, and I was so struck by the holistic approach that he takes. Because when I was a student, we approached it as an animal issue, which was very successful and we had a big impact, but there were always a fairly sizable number of students who would say, oh, you know, no thanks, animals aren't my thing, or I don't really care about animals. And I realized that, you know, these people aren't monsters, as I initially thought, like, who doesn't care about animals? But, you know, they were activists in other ways. They were environmentalists or social justice activists, or they were just so overwhelmed with their own personal lives of studying and everything that they didn't have time to take on a new cause. And so when I read Eating Animals, it really struck me that if we approached the issue more holistically and talked about all of the different facets that are impacted by factory farming, it just becomes so obvious that even if you don't particularly care about animals, if you care about the environment, if you care about other people, or even if you just care about your own personal health, then factory farming is relevant to you. It's really bad in every conceivable way. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to get that message out there to people. At that time, there weren't any organizations that were approaching factory farming as anything other than just an animal welfare, animal rights issue. So I put together a talk that touched on all of the different aspects and started doing outreach.
Well, many of our listeners may be aware of the term factory farming as a whole, but for those who aren't, can you describe to us basically the system of the factory farming industry and why does it even exist? Like, why do we have factory farming? I'm wondering if you could talk about how the meat industry as we know it today evolved from small individually owned farms across North America to now cater a rapidly growing population with a growing hunger for meat.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's a long and complicated story. We actually just recently created a history version of our presentation, but in Eating Animals, Jonathan Safran Foer tells the story of Celia Steele, who was this chicken farmer in the Delmarva Peninsula in Delaware in the 1920s, and she was a backyard chicken farmer, and she placed an order for 50 chicks, and they messed up her order and sent her 500, and she decided to do an experiment and try to raise them in a barn with these new vitamin supplements that had been invented. And actually, so factory farming really grew out of that mistake. The Delmarva Peninsula is still the chicken capital. Now it's filled with factory farms with hundreds of thousands of chickens raised indoors. So from that mistake, I mean, there were also a lot of technological innovations like antibiotics and incubation systems that allowed for the growth of factory farming. And there was also a lot of behind the scenes lobbying by sort of the captains of industry that drove a lot of the small farms out of business. There's a really fantastic book about that called Foodopoly by Winona Hodder of Food and Water Watch that talks about how sort of this, it sounds like a conspiracy theory, but there is this cabal of businessmen and bankers in the early 1900s who wanted to get more young men into their factories and off the farms. And so they actually started this whole program that for a century now has impacted farming and got rid of a lot of small farmers and resulted in a lot of consolidation by these corporations. So that's the short version, if you can believe it, but there's a whole host of forces that have resulted in elimination of small farms and just the consolidation of tens or even hundreds of thousands of animals being raised on these corporate confinement facilities to make the maximum profit out of animal products.
And the number that's being killed is 9 billion yearly?
Yearly in the United States, there are over 9 billion land animals alone that are raised and killed for food.
So how do people who you do your presentations to, like, how are they able to conceive of this idea? Do people even guess that it's 9 billion that are being raised?
No, absolutely not. And we love to start, I mean, I shouldn't say love, it's interesting to start the presentation by having people guess that number, because even adults, and even I spoke to a conference of environmental educators, so these are teachers who focus on the environment, and they guess the same number that most high school and college students guess, which is, you know, maybe 50 million, 100 million, and everyone is just absolutely stunned when we tell them that it's over 9 billion animals. It really starts to drive home the scope of this issue.
Mm-hmm. I'm really interested about the humane education presentations that you give to kids in schools, and a couple of things. How do you get into a system that promotes eating meat? Through, like, school lunches, milk programs? Are they receptive to you coming in? And what are the results like? And what's the feedback from the kids?
Yes, so we reach out to teachers. They're generally receptive, and actually we're really seeing a rise in awareness of this issue and interest in talking about it in the classroom. Just in the last 5 years, I would say a lot more teachers are showing Food Inc., or they're reading excerpts of Omnivore's Dilemma or Fast Food Nation, and incorporating food issues into the curriculum, whether it's English or social science classes. So there is actually a surprising interest in talking about this issue. And, you know, we don't bill ourselves as an animal rights or a vegan organization, and we're very careful to only provide well-researched, cited facts. We're mm-hmm. not going into proselytize. We're giving people information about the impacts of the food system. So that really helps us to get in. It's legitimate information that relates to the curriculum, so that overcomes, you know, some fears that teachers might have.
Right. What's the youngest grade that you go into?
We really focus on high school and college, so we only do outreach to high school and college because we feel that that's the most effective. That's when students can start to make their own decisions about food. So while younger students are certainly passionate and it can have a really big impact on them, there can be more tension there. Parents can get upset if their kids come home and say they don't want to eat the dinners, and then the kids can get frustrated if they don't have any control. So we primarily focus on high school and college, but we do occasionally do elementary school presentations and middle school presentations if teachers reach out to us and request them.
Okay. And what do you do when you're talking about the egg-laying industry? I know a lot of people think that it's okay to eat eggs. Like, how do you approach that?
Well, we have sections on, we talk about eggs, dairy, pigs, and chickens raised for meat. And in all of them, we just go through the standard industry practice. So for eggs, we talk about debeaking. We show a video that all of our presentation is, it's not gory, so we don't show anything that's bloody, but it shows the chicks being spun around in this, you know, industrialized machine that uses a laser to remove the sharp tips of their beaks. And that's always very shocking and disturbing for students to see, because it's just such a far cry from, you know, the happy pictures on the front of the cartons and the, you know, old McDonald's songs that they've been taught in elementary school. So, you know, it doesn't take much that, and, you know, pictures of battery cages, discussion of what life is like for the egg-laying hens, and students see pretty quickly that it's, you know, it's a very far cry from what they thought from the conditions were like for these animals.
Right, and we all know that chickens raised for meat are the most killed land animals on the planet. What are the standard industry practices in raising chickens for meat that you'd like people to know?
Well, One of the most critical issues, and this is one that a number of organizations are starting to focus on for campaigning, is actually just the genes of the chickens. So it's, as some people like to say, the cruelty is really bred into their genetics because they grow so quickly. Chickens raised for meat grow twice as big as they used to in just half of the time. And so 90% of the chickens can't even walk normally because their legs can't support that huge amount of body weight. And because they grow so quickly, they're actually ready to be slaughtered. They're fully grown when they're only 6 weeks old, so they haven't even hit puberty at that point. They're really still just babies in a sense.
I think I heard in one of your presentations that raising broiler chickens for size is akin to actually raising a 12-year-old human child to be 600 pounds.
Yes, that's correct.
That's crazy, and that's a really good way, I think, to sort of get people to understand the scale of the industry. So I like that your organization actually takes an intersectional approach in the education that you convey, and I want to talk about some of the intersecting topics that cross over into factory farming issues. The environmental and public health issues are both huge, and I understand that you've been involved in influencing the Climate Reality Project by Al Gore. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I was invited to speak to the San Francisco chapter of the Climate Reality Project. So there's a national organization, actually international, and then they have regional chapters of individual presenters who go out and speak to their communities about climate change. So I was invited to speak to the San Francisco chapter because in the Climate Reality Project slides, there is very little information about animal agriculture. There are two slides with just a bit of information. So I spoke to the San Francisco chapter, and I was not sure what to expect. Sometimes with environmental audiences, there can be a fair bit of pushback, you know, people who are really into grass-fed and local meat, that sort of thing. But they were really eager for the information and actually really grateful because they said it's one of the questions that they're asked the most frequently, and it's one that they're less certain of how to address. So that was my start working with the Climate Reality Project, and since then I've attended their national training that they do to help people learn to speak effectively about climate change, and continuing to work with several really wonderful people who I met at that training and hopefully provide some slides that can be used by the Climate Reality presenters to optional slides that they can include in the slide deck that talk about animal agriculture as both one of the leading causes of climate change, but also really one of the most empowering and positive solutions because it's one that's accessible to everyone and one of the areas in which we can make the biggest difference with, you know, really minimal cost. It's not like energy infrastructure or federal policy. It's an area where we can make change starting today.
Right. And another area that I think people really care about is public health, and they don't necessarily realize how animal agriculture intersects with public health issues such as antibiotics being used in meat and therefore not being as effective in our health system. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about those issues?
Yes, you know, that was one of the issues that most struck me when I read Eating Animals was the part on public health and this impending risk of a global pandemic and of antibiotic resistance. I mean, it's really potentially catastrophic. So 80% of antibiotics in the United States are fed to animals on factory farms, and that overuse is breeding what they call superbugs, these bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics. And, you know, it's not just some future threat. MRSA, which is a type of staph infection that's resistant to antibiotics, kills more Americans every year than AIDS does, over 10,000 people. And there's very strong evidence that MRSA started on pig factory farms and that it's still very present in pig factory farms and then spreads to the workers, to the local communities, and to people who are exposed to the undercooked meat or surfaces that the meat has touched. So, I mean, between the superbugs and the risk of these pandemics like swine flu and avian flu, it seems like it's really just a matter of time until we see a pretty catastrophic outbreak as a result of these practices.
Right. And another intersecting issue that you bring to light is the rights of humans, that is human workers in the farming industry, which I think most people don't even think about. They don't realize all the humans who must be actually active in the slaughter industry in order to get animals made into meat and onto people's plates. But the truth is that the slaughterhouse is actually one of the most dangerous jobs in the world. Can you tell us more about this, please?
Yes, I mean, I agree, and it's an issue that really doesn't get enough attention. And unfortunately, I see even You know, vegans and animal rights activists have a tendency to demonize the slaughterhouse workers when really they're just as much victims of the system. So they are often undocumented. These companies are purposely recruiting undocumented workers because most Americans don't want to do a job that's so disturbing and so dangerous and so unpleasant. And so they're exploiting these vulnerable populations who face the most dangerous working conditions among the highest injury rates. They found that Tyson slaughterhouses, Tyson were the largest chicken producers in the world, they were averaging at least one amputation per month. So at least once a month, workers are losing fingers, hands, arms into this equipment. And they've also found that some of the workers were forced to wear diapers because they weren't allowed to take bathroom breaks. So just, I mean, unimaginably horrendous working conditions. And on top of that, many of the workers develop post-traumatic stress disorder from seeing so much suffering and death on a daily basis. I actually spoke to a high school class in the Central Valley in California, and one of the students raised his hand and said that his father had worked in a slaughterhouse 10 years ago, and he would still scream in his sleep. His mother would have to wake up his father because he would have these terrible nightmares about what he had seen in the slaughterhouse. You know, they're not conditions that anyone should have to be subjected to.
Well, I'm wondering, in your presentations, does this particular intersection, that is workers' rights, affect people, do you think, who wouldn't normally care about animal rights?
Yes, definitely. I mean, our general presentation, we talk about animals, workers, and the environment, and we found that high school and college students, you know, they generally care about justice issues. So whether that's animal rights, whether that's sustainability, or whether it's human rights, I mean, there's something in there for everyone. And between those three topics, I mean, people are always shocked and horrified and motivated to make change. And I think that, you know, showing them all together, it really demonstrates, again, that it's just bad in every possible way. And there's not really a justification for all of these things that are going on. And it also helps to dispel that stereotype that probably a lot of your listeners have encountered, that, you know, people who care about animal rights somehow don't care about human rights. So it definitely helps to show that interconnection.
Well, I really like the way that you're really factual and concise and just really clear in your personal presentations that I've seen online. But I have also noticed that in your presentations, you make a point of individualizing the animals because, you know, speaking in general terms about 9 billion animals, as we said, it's probably too much for people to handle and actually process in their minds. So can you tell us about this approach of individualizing animals and how you recommend that people, our listeners, can actually make personal connections with farmed animals who we want to advocate for?
Definitely. So, I mean, we do like to give the 9 billion figure to contextualize it for people, especially understanding the environmental impact. It doesn't really make sense until you start to realize, you know, think about all the problems with human overpopulation and then think that there are more farmed animals in the U.S. than there are people in the entire world, and imagine all those animals, you know, eating and breathing and pooping. And so for the environmental section, those numbers are important for understanding. But in terms of animal suffering, I mean, there are a lot of studies that show that when people are confronted with these mass numbers, then it just becomes a statistic and it seems hopeless. And so they're much less motivated to make change or to donate or to get involved because it just seems like too big of a problem. Whereas if they're faced with an individual story of one person, then that it's much more relatable. They can connect to it and it seems like something they can actually help make a difference. So we're careful to balance those two approaches, that while we do paint the big picture, we also tell those individual stories about farmed animals that have been rescued. And we like to use those in particular, that those stories that have a happy ending, because, you know, it's so shocking and so disturbing and depressing. It's easy for people to get overwhelmed and just turn off. You know, it's too painful for them, and so they just check out. And that's part of the reason that we don't use really graphic videos as well, because we want people to be able to stay engaged and kind of keep their emotions open the whole time. So knowing that there are these individual stories and that there are these animals that have had happy endings really helps people to imagine that there could be happy endings for all of these animals.
Well, finally, I want to ask you if you could speak about the professional speaker training that you give for presentations, because you're FFAC, Factory Farming Awareness Coalition. You are a nonprofit. You're based in the States. I know you have a chapter in Toronto. How can people get involved if they want to learn how to give the presentations that you've prepared?
Yeah, so there are several different ways that people can get involved. If they live in cities where we have chapters, then our presenters come out and speak for free. We really love to get referrals. And if they live in a city where we don't have a chapter, then if they want to use our slides and scripts, we make them available for free for anyone anywhere to spread this information in their community. And we're also starting to do a lot more webinars. So people are part of a class or group that would like to have one of our presenters, you know, kind of Skype in, then we would be happy to present that way as well. So people can go to our website, which is www.ffacoalition.org. And there's a place to sign up to volunteer and to donate and also to sign up for a presentation. So once people fill out the form about either giving a presentation or hosting a presentation, then one of our coordinators will get in touch.
Well, thank you, Katie, for coming on the show today to speak with us about your work at the Factory Farming Awareness Coalition for World Farmed Animals Day on October the 2nd. For more information on FFAC's work, as Katie said, you can visit ffacoalition.org. Thank you, Katie. Have a good day.
Thanks, Katie.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for that great interview, Allison and Jillian. I'm going to quickly plug one more event here before we wrap up the show. Tomorrow, Saturday, September 30th, from 12 p.m. to 5 p.m., there's an eco pop-up at 1265 West 13th Avenue. That's near Granville and Broadway. Hundreds of stylish, pre-loved fashions and quality women's wear, designer pieces available from all sorts of designers. All items priced between $5 and $25, with 50% of all sales to be donated to various rescue groups, including the Whale Sanctuary Project. So definitely check out our Facebook page. We'll have more info posted on there. And this is hosted by Jen Dobell, our animal voices.
That's why she's not here today. She's busy with other animal activism. Thank you, Jen. Mm-hmm.
You have been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Please join us on our next show on Friday, October the 6th. It's our annual Thanksgiving show, and we'll be sharing turkey stories and discussing how celebrating a holiday that is compassionate to all beings. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Animalvoices.org is where you can stream shows or download the shows as podcasts, read our show blog with detailed links, and subscribe via iTunes. Stay in touch with us via our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. You can also send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. To end the show today, we are playing a song dedicated to the 9 billion farmed animals on the planet. This is One Species by True Nature. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
An ice cream.